right up here handy. And then to bring us home is Newell Kitchen, who is the overall leader and organized this whole effort and then led it. And so Newell is going to talk about some of the outcomes going forward of the project. So, Newell?
Well, we hope that this approach was the right type of thing for this kind of a project, where we could just sit there and hit some of the highlights. Interestingly enough, John mentioned that it was at these meetings that this thing started, and it was actually not just at these meetings, but it was at these meetings here at this location 4 years ago. So it's kind of a full circle of life kind of a thing to be able now to report with regards to this this project. It gives a little bit of a testimonial to the value of these meetings. It's an incubator for projects that are, I think, successful projects. That sometimes you're not going to get that unless you get the face-to-face and you get discussions going in the hallway that extend here and there, and before the end of the meeting you've got something that's generated and happening. So he started at a high level. I'm going to end at a high level relative to this project. We recognize this project is not a three-year project. This is really almost a decade-type project, and there's different phases of this project. There was the collection phase, which was the three growing seasons of 14 through 16, and then the final certification of that data in early this year. The second phase is really what I call the graduate student degree and publication phase. Our five graduate students, really six different degrees, because one of the students is getting 2 degrees out of this project. And we're in that phase right now, and many of them are graduating or near graduation and hopefully looking for employment. Then more of an enhanced analysis and publication phase that will extend over a few more years. If you read the article that we put together in the Agronomy Journal that was published earlier this year about this project, we anticipate to, as a part of this project, to continue to get a lot of science out of it, but then open this data set, publish the data set so others can use this too, and look for that 2 or 3 years down the road from now. So one of the real values of, again, has been mentioned over and over, is that the wide array of weather and soil conditions. We wanted to really stretch that out. Oftentimes what's done is within states, we push that out by virtue of the way this was organized. And that really allowed us to get a lot of different conditions throughout the whole Corn Belt region of the U.S. This will take a few minutes to explain here. So the different, what we have here is a graph of EONR in pounds per acre, and we have on the x-axis the different states, and then the higher productive soil site that was selected for that state, along with the lower productive. And it wasn't necessarily a low productive, it was lower than the high, relative to the high. These were all still fairly productive sites that were selected. And then the three different color of greens represent the 3 years associated with the project. So now we're looking at those 49 different EONRs associated with the at planting. And the reason why I wanted to show this, I wanted to show you the wide range of variable EONR values that you have. And this is the challenge. How do you come up with tools and measurements that really can get you focused in on what the rate should be? And all the way from zero up to that 280 or 315 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. So there's a lot of range of variation. There's some things too that are kind of interesting as you look within a state. For example, if we look within Illinois, you can see here the high productive sites were really pretty narrow between the 3 years, versus the low productive sites, there's much more variability there. If you look at the North Dakota sites, interestingly, there's a lot more variability. There's variability between the two, the high and the low, but notice how both in 2016, both of the sites, you just didn't need any nitrogen. I mean, they had really good weather conditions, mineralization conditions, and such, to where you just didn't need to add nitrogen, but not the case the first 2 years. You look at the Nebraska sites. Richard's sites that he picked that year are the 3 years for the high producing sites. They're on the lower end, less than 100 pounds per acre for the three. But you can see for his lower producing sites, they're all the other side. And these are sandier sites, and there's the propensity for loss that Jason and others talked about. And so in the EONR is much higher. So there's some things you can quickly start to see. But again, the big thing is that it's this wide range. Now, if you look at and compare the planting With the split application, what you do see is things do start to collapse into the middle a little bit. The range from zero up to the 280 pounds per acre is still there, but things get pushed into the middle. So it's a little easier to get to that EONR, estimate of that EONR when you do that split application. So, and you can see that summarized in these box and whisker plots at planting. The box is a lot larger. You push it to the split application, and things kind of get pushed into the middle a little bit more. The EONR, median EONR split is just a titch below, not significantly different, but a titch below with the split than the at planting over the 49, all of the sites. If you look at the yield at EONR, this is a kind of a level of the productivity that we have at the different sites. So we, median is well above the 200 bushel per acre for both at planting and split. And a little tick up with the bushels per acre with the split over the at planting. Now this is a yield response that's a little bit different than what Jim was showing. So this is looking at the yield response to nitrogen application. So this is above what you got at the check, and you can see that there's a slight difference between the two, but again, pretty good response to nitrogen across all of the sites that we have. So then if you look at that agronomic efficiency, where you're taking the kilograms of grain per kilogram of nitrogen or bushels of grain per pound of nitrogen, you can see we're working with those same numbers. It kind of causes a little bit of a shift between the split and that planting, but again, a wide range of variation between all of the sites. So this is kind of the take home that we have here. Is we have all these different conditions, a lot of different numbers now to work with. The data is certified, the graduate students are working with it, and we can continue to try to tease out of it a better understanding of how we can both test tools and maybe modify tools going forward. Project outcomes. For plot research, this was big data. 49 response environments, 920 measurements of soil characterization, over 3,000 yield canopy sensor kind of plots, experimental unit, nearly 20,000 nitrate and ammonia analyses, 17,000 records, weather records. So it's a lot of data there that's assembled together that we can use, a lot of good descriptors, the metadata associated with this that we feel like it's going to be very valuable in the years to come. We have the 6 graduate degree program projects that were completed or are being completed on the project. We anticipate somewhere in between 10 and 16 refereed journal publications out of this, assuming that they get reviewed in a favorable way. And then there's the other part of this, and DuPont Pioneer was the key in making this happen by providing the funding for it, and if it's a part of that, they've been able to use the same data set to kind of look at the model calibration and validation of the work that they are interested in, and John mentioned that at the beginning. So that we feel like some fairly significant type things that have come out of this. Other project positives that I would like to kind of end on, and that is, it allowed us to really focus on a specific need across a broad region, and so many research funding projects that come through public funding want it to be lots of things. You know, you can't get funding unless you're going to say you're going to do everything. And lots of times that makes it very difficult to do a very good job with anything when you're having to do so many things. So this allowed us to really focus on a very specific thing. The funding of the crop production need that publicly funded research programs have avoided in recent decades. Nitrogen fertilization work is kind of not easy to get funding through the public venues. The unified protocol development was really key and a positive part of this project, and makes it the data set, I think, glue together in a way we can do some things. The reduced bureaucracy and paperwork often associated with public funding, more time to do the research, it really was consolidated, and that really is, in my way of thinking of it, it was a real positive. And then the efficiency with purchases and laboratory costs, it was centralized. A lot of this was done in such a way that it was paid once through DuPont Pioneer, as opposed to being distributed to all the universities and have them individually have to work through their accounting offices. And so there was a lot of efficiency in this thing. And so that was a real positive. And then kind of a final thing, more about a human side of this for myself is I kind of got into agronomy because I wanted to be out in the field. I wanted to do things, you know, in the field. And for myself, a positive outcome is it kind of allowed me to get out into the field, and not just in the Missouri fields, to really kind of get out there and see across the landscapes of that we have here in the U.S. Midwest, and to travel a lot of miles and see a lot of things and see a lot of different soils, and kind of get in touch again with the things that drive agronomy. For me personally, that was a huge positive of this project. To most of the sites, almost all of the sites, I was able to get onto myself, and so that was a really interesting way of doing this research. And for the graduate students who are now working with this data across the whole region, I think that's a real plus for them too. So with that,
thank you, Newell. And I'll remind you once again, for those that want CCA, sign up, we've got it here. Otherwise, and thank the speakers, that 5-6 minutes goes pretty fast, so we rather stayed on time with that. But more importantly, presented some key points and got those out there in the time. We have time for some discussion now. We held the questions till the end, so...
You want the speaker just come up the front here? You want the speakers all to come up?
Sure, if you would like to do that. We're a little...
Now there's more speakers in the front than people in the audience, so that's not a good sign.
An overpower.
I guess this could be for anybody, but we talked just now about the positives of the project. Anything that might have been negative that you would do differently on another project of this scale?
That's a good question. Ander, would we focus most of the time? What went up? I'm sure.
I don't know if this is sometimes I think it's a negative because there's 12 co-authors on my manuscript. but it's been a really good learning experience. Like the communication and everything between me and the co-authors, like it's been, just a great experience to see their points of view. When you write a manuscript, you can't be perfect. Even there's conflicting, opinions on how you should write one paragraph or delete it or whatever it is. So I don't know. At some point, like I said, I seem like it's a negative, but in the overall scheme of things, it has been just an absolute amazing thing to work with so many cool authors and investigators from these different states. And
the other questions?
Yeah.
Any other reactions to that question?
One of the questions about making nitrogen recommendation that I'd like you to comment on is the risk when we look at our R-square values and we do our plots. A number of good growers say, well, when we're getting 80% of the time, whatever, doing well, but what if my point is one that's below the line? Is not enough that's been recommended in other yield. Any thought been given to how we deal with somehow incorporating that into our decision tools?
Good question, Mark. I've thought about that, and I think that there's ways, and I'm not necessarily promoting MRTM, as an example for many of the states use that, we look at what's the calculated maximum return and then we use a range of N rates that produce profitability within $1 per acre. And then provide, at least in Wisconsin, we provide growers guidance on when you might want to think about being upper end of the range or lower.
Right.
But yeah, we probably should hook up with some economists.
Well, this data set looks to me like it offers the best thing I've seen to try to address this issue.
To your thoughts, I think we're moving towards the point where we can start to assign probabilities and risks to the data that we offer for growers trying to make that decision. so that they can say, your risk of having not enough nitrogen is X percent, and then you decide how much risk you want to assume or take. And I think that's about the best that we can do. We can't take away all risk.
No, they're going to make the risk. They make the decision.
But if you can provide enough information to say what that risk might be, then I think that's. And then the second thing, I think Karen's presentation kind of talked about that, is I think we really have to shift from thinking about yield, only yield loss, to yield plus environmental aspects. And I think she covered that well. That we got to think about how much nitrogen we're losing out of the system, as well as how much we need to produce.
When I look at the statistics that you were showing on the maximum return to nitrogen, it showed that those two are identical. You were talking about it as if one was better than the other, but when the statistics said they're both B's.
That's Curtis.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of emphasis on how do we move to this maximum return to nitrogen relative to the corn yield. Your data does not support that. What are your thoughts about that?
I mean, due to the range of UNRs, I mean, the range for that difference was quite high. So, I mean, it's hard to find a significant difference with the data set. But given that, you know, the majority of the sites with MRTN was a lot better than, say, use the pre-plant nitrogen tests, and then also the cost of using that seemed to be a little better. So, I mean, not saying that MRTN is the silver bullet, but it seemed to be more efficient at getting a little higher percent. Granted, not all tools, I mean, 60% of the tools, 60% of the sites weren't accounted for with any of the tools. So, I mean, looking at it from that point of
view. Did you see places where it worked better than others? I mean, the question is, as you're trying to do this thing across, is there areas that it worked better than yet where you saw differences relative to where those locations were?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still trying to tease that out, but there are, I mean, off the top of my head, I think, like, Missouri was very difficult, low organic matter, high weather, so that one kind of fell apart. But kind of the middle range, Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, those seem to be, you know, pretty easy to account for that. Whereas North Dakota, I mean, it was high organic matter, precipitation was varied by year to year, so it was very difficult to you know, nail those down.
I think to follow up on that as well, consider that MRTN isn't not like everybody's using 1.2, you know, a field goal. We're all using the same method of data analysis, and each state has its own data, so it can maybe do better in some states than others, depending on the robustness of the data that's feeding into it, and how the different states maybe tease apart groups of sites or locations in different states. So there's more work we can do on it.
Okay. Dave, you had a comment?
Yeah, I do. You know, I'm a Trump co-author, so, but that's a really good question about instilling a little bit of confidence in growers and getting a fallback. And one of the things I suggest is going back to that enriched strip thing that, you know, go ahead and do with the MRTN or whatever your recommendation is, but then in a soil within a variety, put out, you know, another 50, another 100 pounds of N. If you got a sensor, use it. If not, look at it. Some people just look at it and say, well, you know, it looks the same as the rest of the field. I'm not going to do anything else. So it gives them some confidence that what they're doing is the right thing.
And to add to what you said there, Dave, the growers in the irrigated corn belt area, they're a lot more comfortable doing that. The grower that I worked with last year, he under-applied by quite a bit, but because he's got the pivot there that can apply 30 pounds of N, like that recommendation at a specific point in time, they're not as concerned about
under-applying, if you will.
So that's unique to the irrigated corn production. Doesn't work maybe in Illinois. Well, I'm sure Emerson would probably agree with that.
And I'll mention quick, I want to recognize Dave as a co-author, Fabian here, and then John Sawyer, Emerson Nafsinger, and Richard Ferguson were other principal investigators that were also involved, and you saw them up on John's screen. So, sir?
Yeah, you mentioned in your slide about the different tools that you kind of did, and you
said ADAPT-N was one of them, but I didn't see the results from ADAPT-N. I'm
well,
curious on that one.
So I tried to just do public available,
okay.
And since ADAPT-N is private,
okay.
I didn't include that analysis. I would love to, but.
Okay,
just
curious.
Peter?
You collected very nice data sets, 49 trials across 3 years, across many states, but from our perspective, how can you verify this number, this recommendation for a farmer? They usually don't apply 5 days or 6 days of nitrogen. Is any type of mechanism that a farmer can, in the end of the season, can know that if per day was plus minus 50 or 60?
Well, I think that they don't want to do more work, but if they took or hired their consultant to do a residual soil nitrate profile, I think that would be a good way to see if there's too much left, see how they're doing. You might not know about early season losses with that, but you get a sense of whether the rate was just overall too high. I mean, based on the data that we've collected. We don't have anything like the stock nitrate test or anything like that. That was information stuff.
We've done on-farm trials with our Encirca tool with a farmer practice versus the tool, but there's an evaluation there, but you still don't know which if either one was right or close to UNR. That's the challenge. Well, some of it comes down to a huge amount of faith and confidence that's developed over time in the tools and then the people that recommend them as well.
I think, you know, this boils down to the fact that we are, as a farmer, you're not interested in what happens across the Midwest, you're interested in what happens at your farm.
Yep.
And the only way that you can really get to that is by doing this kind of work. I mean, you have to have trials where you can apply different rates and see what the response is. I mean, we see it in our latest data that even some of those sites that were very close, they were different years, but they were very close to each other. You see that the UNR is vastly different from year to year.
So going forward, you know, you hope that the data set, and that's the discussion we had early on, is what data do we need to collect to test the tools that are kind of currently out there and be able to test them in a side-by-side manner, just like a Consumer Reports kind of a thing. But also what tools may be coming online and what information might we need. Now, undoubtedly, we will have not collected some pieces of information that we should have. But we did try to really go after this in a way to where we could say at some point, if there's another tool that's coming on, that this data set could be used as a validation data set to other, you know, other tools. It's got a robust soil information. It's got robust weather information. It has a lot of in-season and uptake information. End of season, post-harvest soil nitrate. It's all there that hopefully you can then turn around and kind of continue to evaluate the decision tool that's out there or potentially still coming online.
Are there any measurements that, I guess, in hindsight, you wish you maybe wouldn't have taken or anything else?
Wouldn't have taken or would?
Wouldn't have. Could have.
Well, if we had an army. I mean, there's limitless things you can pick up. I mean, you know, would it have been interesting to have, like, stock nitrate to really see how well does that really work? I'm a skeptic on the data that I've collected in Wisconsin, and I've seen other data that looks reasonable. So I think there's always those what-if situations, but it's really, there's time and money, and I don't know the pioneers got more money.
I mentioned in mind that we just looked at the Haney soil health test in the last year of the study. A large part of that was because we didn't keep and process soils the right way in the first 2 years. A lot of it we did centrally and we sent a lot of them, but there was some of the sampling, some of the background sampling from the sites, some of our initial sampling that was kind of handled individually by states. So some of that kind of got lost and hard to find. So I think from the get-go, and centralize all the soil samples that would have been helpful.
But I would say 98% of the samples, we still have. They're archived and they're in our
our warehouse. We had to build a warehouse pretty much for this.
I might give a comment. But one of the reasons that Pioneer funded this is we started out to validate the models for Inserca with on-farm trials, with a preliminary kind of primordial model. And we, and our data scientists and our modelers told us, after looking at some of that so-called big data and just collecting a lot of data from on-farm, or from our yield trials where you have one or two nitrogen rates or you don't even know for sure what the nitrogen rates were or what form, that they would rather have few locations. Now, I'm not talking about Peter's question of validating farmer field, but I'm talking about model validation and development and calibration. They would rather have fewer locations where a lot was measured so that they could really track the processes in the nitrogen cycle, the mineralization, leaching, uptake. And so they really like this, and then unfortunately I can't talk much about what they're doing, but there's a lot of work being done. But if anything, they would, I think we had, they would want more frequent samples throughout the year. And that, again, we budgeted with a balance of what we could fund there, but we had a BT sample, a pre-plant sample, an NZ sample, three or four samples during the season. If anything, our modelers tell us that more is better, even more would be better. Now, it's not practical. That's what a data scientist and a crop modeler tells us.
There's a lot of interest in satellite imagery, and every third person's got a drone of some kind. Did any of you have drones or that kind of information from your flocks?
Pioneer actually.
Yeah. Imagery was measured at least once. I think we got it at least once on all the trials. In some cases, twice. So that data is there. It's available. It was collected.
It's actually an unexplored domain of the data set right now. None of the graduate students are really doing anything with that, but it's there, and it's one of those things we, you know, anticipate could be done here in the next year now.
Yeah. We worked to capture it once. Usually it was our two or so, I think in most cases, but we had a few sites where we got it earlier at B9 or to B14 at a vegetative stage, so.
Are these all Pioneer hybrids or
We supplied the seeds, and it was all genetics was really not a component of the study. There were just, as you saw in the design, there was just one hybrid at each location. We did do a little effort to try to get some commonality by maturity, so that the southern areas had one maturity, the central had another maturity, and I think Dave was up there by himself with an early maturity.
In talking about this partnership, I remember some of the earlier discussions. I mean, this was not kind of a one way, we will do it the university way or the Pioneer way. It was working together to figure out what was the best out of it. And I remember some of the earlier discussions that these trials were going to be a lot more focused on different types of hybrids. Mm-hmm. And we decided as a group, no, actually, you know, let's just keep one hybrid for location and focus on some other aspects.
You'd have to make a decision. Is it even if you went to two hybrids, we were pretty much with the resources you had. Then you have to give up. Are you going to plant all in one nitrogen timing? Well, you really don't want to give up the comparison of pre-plant versus in-season. Are you going to give up some the number of increments of N rates that you had are really important for calculating EONR. You hate to give up those, so. You decided we'll attack that another way.
Certainly many other components of the 4R, you know, source and other things that we could have considered, that we wanted to really kind of focus on that rate question, which a lot of those tools are kind of built on. And just an optimization of what can you do with what you have and the time and resources.
All right. Any last questions? Otherwise, I think we've wrapped up our time. So thank you all for coming and your interest in